Well, ladies and gentlemen, we now come to the final session of the colloquium. When I asked Eric who he would like to chair, he said you, provided you agree not to tell the truth. I promise, however, to tell the truth almost. And I'd like to begin with a story. Long ago, when the world and we were much younger, and when we had rather more hair and rather more illusions about the nature of higher education, Eric and I attended a formal dinner in this university to mark the establishment of this institute. The story, which was told by the then American minister in London, concerned the fact that on a Cunarder in the early years of this century, there were the two best speakers in the world, Mark Twain and Chauncey Depoe. The captain decided to put to the test what everyone was talking about and asked them both to speak after dinner on the first night out. Chauncey Depoe got up and, in the opinion of those present, gave the most brilliant and effective speech that they had ever heard. It had wit, humanity, compassion, humour, everything. He sat down to tumultuous applause. Twain then shambled to his feet and drawled, "Well, Mr. Captain, I'm very pleased to opportunity to say a few words, and I'm particularly glad to have met Mr. Chauncey Depoe again. In fact, we met on deck for the first time this morning, and we took a few strolls, and as a result of that, we agreed that he would write my speech and I would write his." And he sat down. Now, at this point, I am tempted to sit down and say no more myself. But to do so would be to deprive me of the opportunity to celebrate the many years of friendship I have enjoyed with Eric and also to pay tribute to his long and greatly valued association with our institute, which in a small way we have sought to commemorate today. A few years ago, some of you may remember, Arnold Goldman, when confronted by a similar task, claimed that one could no more introduce Eric than one could present an elemental force of nature. And I'm not even going to try. He is known to each and every one of you in this room, and your presence testifies to the affection and high regard in which he is held. I would like to say, however, that my own recollections of Eric go back almost 30 years to the early 1960s when, after war service in the Far East, 3 years at Cambridge and the necessary number of Wanderjahre in Southeast Asia, Switzerland, and Holland, he had settled into one of the first designated posts in American literature in this country at King's College. And there he has taught for 30 years, with one term off for good behavior, and a year as an ACLS fellow in New York in the middle 60s. And that, I'm sure he would agree, was Eric's annus mirabilis. And interestingly, he has given us the first of a two-volume essay on this year in the bulletin of our former Students Association. It's therefore entirely appropriate that today's proceedings should be in his honor, because for 24 of these 30 years, Eric has been a true and staunch friend of the Institute, regularly offering a seminar on American Cultural Studies in our MA program, ever willing to help either directly or indirectly with the advancement of the Institute's activities and reputation. I think it's also true to say that he's now the sole in-post survivor of discussions in smoke-filled rooms of the 1960s in which the conception and gestation of the Institute took place. Certainly, in his capacity as a member of our Committee of Management, and more latterly, our Advisory Committee, he represents a rare and unbroken link with those years. Nevertheless, for me today, he is still essentially the same dynamic intellectual force that I remember marching into battle against entrenched ranks of prejudice and superstition, also known then as the Board of Studies in English. The lineaments of the teacher and the scholar are sufficiently well known to you. Those of the musician and cook, perhaps. Dozens of Eric's former students now teach all over the world. His official list of publications must run into 10 or 12 single-spaced A4 pages, which cumulatively, I think, illustrate the drastic intelligence and the informed enjoyment which he brings to both his reading and his writing. But standing here, I would very briefly like to draw attention to another aspect of his intellectual and pedagogical role, and that is the, to my mind, a quite extraordinarily generous way in which, over the years, he has constantly made his energy and his resources available to all. Whether institutionalized in the form of a CNAA or external examining, or more immediately and directly to any interested inquirer, be he or she a fugitive from inadequate supervision in universities considerably older than this. Or a mere member of his many audiences in Budapest or Philadelphia, Paris, which recently held a series of readings and lectures in his honor, Paris or Hyderabad. This openness to experience, together with his capacity for friendship, brings to mind another Eric, with whom I think I am probably the most familiar here. And this is the Trans-Severn Maritime Eric, who in the last 15 years or so has developed a deep affection, which I think amounts to love, for my native Pembrokeshire, where hill and cliff, sea, and I fear restaurant all acknowledge his august presence. And from a whole quiver of memories, I would, with your indulgence, like to pluck but one, and it really stems from a photograph that shows Eric entering an opalescent sea in late afternoon, flanked by my two daughters. Earlier that day, he had pointed out to him the seaweed, which is used for the making of that delectable, comestible lava bread. But before he could be told that it was customary for the seaweed to be boiled for 8 hours, preferably with a ham hock, Eric had plucked a frog from a rock, ate it with obvious relish, and announced delicious to a startled audience. I remember this because I think that was the year in which he published his aleatory sequence of poems, Precipice of Fishes. Small volume, which on one level illustrated the truth of Bongay's dictum, if you can kill a snake with it, it ain't art. But at another level, it illustrated the extraordinarily productive meeting of sea, land, and poet. And since he dedicated this sequence of poems to me, somewhat feebly, I remember responding with a spasm of doggerel in reply based upon the photograph of Eric entering the sea with my two daughters. And as I remember, as opposed to his skilled verse, mine read something like this: "Now flanked by naiads slim and serene, the poet enters the watery stream. Protean Eric braves the waves forlorn to hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Who, ere attentive to the poet's wishes, now provides a precipice of fish." More recent memories.
Go on now. You got it.
More recent include his first encounter with a genuine Mabinogian fog upon the Crusader Hills, and his impeccable behaviour as a latter-day Cavalier of the Rose. But the world, I fear, is not yet ready to receive the details of these exploits. I have to report, however, that on his last visit, it was at least 3 days before Eric was seen to open a book. on 14th century Welsh property. Now, whatever that evidence may quite falsely suggest, it is, of course, quite inconceivable that this most preeminent of voices on American cultural studies should be either lulled or stilled. It is, in other words, inconceivable that Eric should retire, whatever the government, the Inland Revenue, or this university may decree. All of us who know this most multifarious of men will, I'm sure, readily agree that here we have a person who will never go gentle into the good night of flaccid retirement. And to vary my poets, you don't have to peer too closely to see that the not so ancient eyes are glittering and gay. Released from such pressing sublunary concerns as yet another tutorial on Gatsby.
Oh God, yes.
Eric, more than most of us, has enviable new fields in which to discharge his creative and his critical energies, and in so doing, continue to enrich and enhance our lives. Throughout the day, he has, with commendable patience, hovered on our battlements, as it were. And I'm all too conscious that, with these few words, I have further delayed his right and proper move to center stage. His talk will bring the colloquium to an end, and I would like to thank him now in advance, not only for his contribution, but also for the generous assistance he has given in planning the day. And if you wish to ask questions, either here afterwards or in the other room in the bar, I'm quite sure that Eric will be happy to talk to you. So, cometh the hour, cometh the man. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and colleagues, with admiration and affection, Eric.
Thank you, Harry. Well, after that,
it was all true.
And as Spike Milligan sometimes says, more where that came from, folks. No, thank you very much, Hal. And thank you very much to the other speakers. I had tremendous inclination just now, as I said to some of you, that I felt what I would like to really do is to throw this away and open the proceedings out to discussion of those four papers we had, which I thought were absolutely terrific. I really enjoyed them very much. I felt very proud to be associated with those, as well as this institute, but I think it must be terribly obvious to everybody how I feel about that. So I'm not going to sentimentalize on, but get down to work. I must say, yes, no more seminars on the Great Gatsby is really something to look forward to. Oh dear, the number of people want to talk about Fitzgerald. Hello. So let me begin this. One of the things that's been most embarrassing, and in fact, when Clive was giving his paper, I was getting a little worried. Where is he?
Yeah.
Yes, I just thought that it was all going to be duplicated, and that was. And it's going to edge in, because you started talking about Rothenberg. I don't know why I've had it now, because I want to talk about Jerome Rothenberg quite a bit. So there are some overlaps here, and also Henry Adam. But it's bound to be, because if we're talking about developments in American cultural studies, and I guess because all four of the speakers and myself are good friends, we're bound to overlap a bit. So to begin with a good statement of a cliche idea by an American scholar I've always admired and used, and with whom I had the privilege of conversation once in his garden. It was an extraordinary morning after a hurricane had hit Boston in 1960. That was Perry Miller. In a piece called Nature's Nation, he takes up the old issue about the shaping of an American character. The reason, I'm quoting, the reason for this national anxiety is that being American is not something to be inherited so much as something to be achieved. I just dumped that also onto the remarks and marvellous quotations that you offered us, Robert. You see how that really relates. Isn't that strange? You can get that right back from 1967 at that point. I'd only add it's the same with the British, is what I want to say. Only I think we all believe that we inherit, even if we are anxiety-ridden. But I was talking about that. We had a conference here run by Harold Daniels with exemplary skill. called the American Presence in Britain, which we had last November. And I gave a paper then on the cultural presence of Americans in Britain. And one of the things I was into was very much to do with, I want to know what Britain is. I don't think there is a national culture anymore at all. And I think this is raises issues again. I think it's, I would like to say that I think what you're saying is being developed here as well and elsewhere. So that part of what I'm saying is to do with the erosions of the whole idea of nationality as fixed boundary area at a time when, ironically, the nationalism in Eastern Europe is taking place. And Americans and us are having to think very hard what we mean by a cultural definition at all of a different kind. So, and it was a very strange feeling about this, as listening to the papers, I kept thinking this all the time. So my talk this afternoon is part of a work in progress, and it really is a description of a field, really. I know some other people had the same problems of having to make lists and catalogue, and I sympathise with that very much. So I feel that I'm entering a field which I want to describe, which I want to describe parts to you. But I think that's good for a colloquium. That is, an investigation of some American writers engaged in intercultural materials and art and ideas. And I'm going to use sections from a very large batch of beginning writings and try to get going a certain field of partial coherences and suggest other parts for investigation. And I wish to acknowledge, by the way, also that the present work moves out from a work I was encouraged to do at the University of Essex by Jacqueline Kay, who I'm glad to say is here. A dear friend, I hope you don't mind me saying, as well as a student at one time. She was involved very much in, I think, one of the most important university activities in this country during the last decade, and that is a cross-cultural studies program, at the University of Essex, in which she very kindly asked me to take part. I felt very strongly about that too, right now, that sense of speaking at her conferences and to her students, drawn from an enormous range of cultures, with North Africans, people from Turkey, and so forth, I'm sure you know. Is it still cancelled? Are they going to start up again?
No, the MA is going to start again.
Oh, good, because I think it's very important there. But there again, as you see the issue I'm making there, Bob, I mean, this is we're into something really big is happening. It's possible to have a university course on cross-cultural studies now and have people there from the other cultures, you see what I mean. But the idiots at the University of Essex decided that it was not a paying proposition or some crapulous thing of that kind. But fortunately, it's starting up again. Anyway, you see the kind of thing I'm interested in. So, engagements then, as what are we? What sort of nationality do we belong to? What sort of cultures are we involved in? One of the things I was talking about last November too was this sense of that the American studies itself has been a way into involving us in cultural studies. I think the idea of cultural studies didn't exist in this country until American studies got going as a cultural studies subject. Now it's the okay phrase, as one of the speakers actually said. And we've been involved in this, John, I think, with our 19th century Anglo-American MA at King's. Because we've got going on things like technology and culture and landscape painting and stuff in an English department course, which is outrageous for our colleagues, I guess we say. But so that it's so nice to see you here, too, because we've worked at that together. So that sense of an American presence in Britain is quite an extraordinary thing to start developing in that particular way. I bet everybody here knows that chapter in Franz Kafka's America, published in 1927, I must say, called The Nature Theatre of Oklahoma. And this was intended to be a point of reconciliation of, and I quote the author, an almost limitless theatre in which his young hero was going to find again a profession, a standby, his freedom, even his old home and his parents, as if by some celestial witchery. This is from Max Brod's postscript to the English translation. Kafka would still be able then to use the term America as a hopeful, non-hierarchical place for a naive immigrant world. Remember, the slogan of the theatre was, "Everyone is welcome." quote, welcome to the biggest theatre in the world. That's how he felt about it. There's a sense of America, for many of us, being that biggest theatre in the world and starting along those lines. But I'm interested in that word limitless that is used in those writings there. That sense of a limitless quality. Now, I want to play that back another way and say, yes, the limits are now taken off. It is really limitless now. And the word America is dissolving. And so it is inverted commas the whole time. Do you see how I'm taking off here from you both there? I think that's it. That sense of a number of writers that I've known and want to talk about, and some I haven't known, I think including Muriel Rukeyser, who you talked about, who was a friend of both of us in that way. But the writers who have regenerated themselves inside their American culture in a cross-cultural, cross-national, cross-frontier set of means of bringing information into their existences as Americans from outside America. The title of the talk originally was much more restricted to writers, but you've got to cut all these things down. And the quotation is, in fact, What a Place to Sleep, is from William Carlos Williams' poem in a book called Pictures from Brussels and Other Poems. It's the title poem of a book inside that book called The Desert Music. He is, at the beginning of the poem, inspecting, I quote, a form prostrate on a bridge between, and this again relates to your thing, Juarez and El Paso. It was a bit strange that was planned before I heard your talk there. It's an unrecognizable shape, but it's egg-shaped. Do you see that? It's that fertile image there on the bridge between the carters there. And he celebrates it, and it begins, What a Place to Sleep. On the international boundary. Where else? Interjurisdictional, not to be disturbed. How shall we get said what must be said? Only the poem. Again, that's inscription matter, is it not? Which you're involved in. So you can have this bit. That is, you make the form, you inscribe it in that sense there. And he says, not prostrate to copy nature, not to imitate, but then I'm paraphrasing, but an awakening, a new dance that resists the law, meaning that strict continuity there. These signs operate then as a signification of making it new, as Pound always said, and Thoreau before him, with the same Chinese quotation, at the frontier with another culture. The form can give birth. Charles Olson, a writer whose name also appeared in our discussions today in Clive's paper, Charles Olson wrote in the Black Mountain Review for summer 1954 of the great frontier is not over. What is metropolis, despite the appearances. He was in fact reviewing Ernst Robert Curtius's European Literature and the Latin Middle Ages. And he dedicated his Maximus poems in 1960 to the American poet from Robert Creeley with the words, for the figure of outward. The figure of outward. At the bottom of that page, all my life I've heard one makes many. And the third poem in Maximus 4 of 1968 begins a frontier action like this. All my life I've heard about many. He went to Spain, the handsome sailor. He went to Ireland, and he died of a bee. This is an ancient myth, by the way. He's buried at the hill of Knockmanee. He sailed to Cashies and wrecked on that ledge. His ship vaulted the shoal. He landed in Gloucester. He built a castle at Norman's Woe. And all those references are totally international all down the page. That is, he's saying it's a location and then dissolving the location as a way of moving into the poem in that particular way. I was thinking of your stuff about Kernewick that you did in that book of poems years ago, it seems to be now. But that was examining that sort of place that dissolved, wasn't it, and moved at the same time, or static at the same time. Alan Fisher, one of our best poets here. Another way in, there's lots of ways in. A statement by one, and Alan, you know her, one of the most remarkable American writers in the visual arts during the past three decades, Doree Ashton. She's written a very interesting article, I don't know whether you know it, called Round Trip, The Arts as Cross Cultures. I'll Xerox it for you. It's in Chelsea magazine number 47. It begins with a statement by Jorge Luis Borges shortly before his death when he's 86. I am a poet, an anarchist, and a cosmopolitan. Nationalism is the greatest curse of the modern world. And Ashton believes this to be characteristic of what she calls the early modern tradition. Artists were declaring themselves free of the suffocating boundaries that nationalism sought to enforce, declaring themselves cultural voyagers who are not to be hostages either to history or geography. And this position, she says, causes the definition of culture to be problematic, and I'm quoting, the mapping of cross-cultural influence become key admirations, key addresses, and key actions. Cultures travel like pollen. Cultures travel like pollen. It's not a question of melting pot, as we heard earlier. Always an insultingly accurate term. I mean, who's melting, you know? And who's the pot? Ridiculous. As much as America, it's just like Americans saying Europe, you know, or certain people keep saying Africa. Ashton produces a useful story here of the excellent American comic writer S.J. Perelman, who studied surrealist art in Paris and writing in Paris in the 20s, returned to America and wrote scripts for the Marx Brothers, and then found that the critics were saying what marvelous surrealists the Marx Brothers were. And that's a classic example of the of those techniques being in a cross-cultural field. Except the critics thought that they were American natural surrealists, and I quote. That's a beautiful phrase, American natural surrealists. Ashton also records the young Ashar Gorky, great artist who recently had an exhibition down at the Whitechapel, and Jackson Pollock sweeping the floor at the Guggenheim Museum when they're actually destitute, when they're very young, and allowed to see the private collection of Kandinsky's that Guggenheim had collected before the Second World War. And that was an example of a quite casual intercultural action with no choice at all. They have to see it when they were sweeping out the floor. So we don't need the scholars to say much more than that. I want to remember too, because I'm writing something about it at the moment, I was fascinated years ago by Charles Olson's use of Henri Corbin, writing on Avicenna and Sufic adepts, the concept of Tawil, which is a kind of through organized symbolism in writing, which Robert Kelly, the American poet, also took up, among other poets. And Olson's use of parts of the Gilgamesh epic and Hesiod, and his training of students at the State University of New York in Buffalo in non-Greek and non-Christian mythology, one result of which was a great collection of creation texts from the ancient Mediterranean called Origins. And those people here attending my Thursday afternoon seminars remember that we're into this one, John Cousins, Richard, there. Translated as a marvelous book called Origins, and they're translated with notes by Charles Doria and Harris Lenowitz in 1976. And it was called a Christomathy, characteristically using the Greek word for useful learning. It's a collection of texts for the acquisition of knowledge, not some antiquarian scholarly self-blessing. What useful knowledge might be in this cross-cultural area was the subject of Olson's letters too in 1950s, from Washington DC, from Central America, and from Black Mountain College in North Carolina, to Sid Corman, who was then planning a magazine to be called Origin, one of the most important American journals of poesis, that is, of poetry, of techniques, and of information. And the book came out, as many of you know, called Letters for Origin, 1950-1956, published, we should be proud to say, in London by Kate Goliard, one of whose editors and publishers was a distinguished British poet, Tom Raworth. That was 1969. It remained a key text for American cross-cultural studies, and their centrality for a sense of ethnocentric culture. So I think the ethnicity starts here as well, is what I'm adding to you here, Bob. Also, I've got some bits on the gate in the centre as well, which Clive was using, which is an essay by Charles Olson, which distinguishes immediately between knowledge and, he says, what prostitutes itself into the preservation of the state's authoritarian insistences, imposed classifications that the state needs, and the restriction thereby of discovery. And he challenges a narrow concept of centre, of single centre, of what, I quote, the will to cohere might be. And it concludes like this. He's moving into a major issue for the democratic proposition, always a central issue for America and for us, needless to say. Quote, the proposition is a simple one, and the more easily understood now that we have been shocked at what we did not know nature's energy is capable of generally. Energy is larger than man, but therefore, if he taps it as it is in himself, he uses of himself one extensible in human directions and degree not recently granted. The exceptional man, the hero, and he puts that in inverted commas, loses his description as genius, in inverted commas. His birth is mere instrumentation for supplication to the energy he did not create. It becomes instead image of possibilities, implicit in the energy, given the methodology of its use by men, from the man capable of precisely this, and only this, kind of intent and attention. He then adds materials from the history and myths of Eastern Mediterranean, including Gilgamesh, Apollonius of Tyana, Sumerian precedents of Buddha, a figure called Gouda. And the issue is the Sanskrit inscription, the guardianship of the earth is the ruler's special province as part of the whole question and continuing struggle to remain civilized. Doria and Leonowitz's Origins is significantly prefaced by one of America's finest poets and experts in ethnopoetics as a field of cross-cultural action, Jerome Rothenberg. He quotes Olson in the preface of the book as the powerful intersection of contemporary writing methods and newly available, quote, pre-Homeric and pre-Mosaic texts, which are themselves eye-openers towards, quote, new discourse. Still quoting, the change in the language and structure isn't peripheral, but central. The change in the language and structure isn't peripheral, but central. Symptomatic of a complex of openings. That is, a change from the bias of our culture towards the Hellenic and Hebraic. Shades of Matthew Arnold, I may say, still struggling on about that in Culture and Anarchy, is it not, John, there? He's talking about Olson there, part of the ways, I quote, adventuresome scholars and poets recognize that the history and roots of our civilization need to be re-examined and revised in the light of new knowledge. Further, Rothenberg extends his argument into the broader necessary field, as many of you know, I'm sure, so brilliantly assembled and notated and placed within his own poetry, saying this, these materials aren't taken as philosophy or theology per se, but poesis, the making or shaping of reality through speech. As I bet Robert has been calling inscription. The narrative here is constantly in the process of defining itself, not the recollection of ur-texts, but mind as witness to its own creations. I'd like to say, in honor of the University of Kiel, in the Bruce Center there, that in 1985 there was an extraordinary conference which Dave Murray took part in, if you remember there, called Fictions of History and History of Fictions. Most of those papers are now published in a book called American Literary Landscapes, the Fiction and the Fact. Very much there was a sense there of defining some interface, intercultural interface, between fiction and history, that is, history taken as non-fiction, and fiction taken as being nothing whatever to do with history. There's that sense of the language begins to break down, but we need the new terms for something else. Rothenberg is into that by talking about the necessity to allow the clash of symbols, which those like Ricoeur tell us, both in natural, that is natural to the mind, and forms which are a sure hedge against idolatry. There's more to be said about Rothenberg and his exemplariness, I think, than that. By the way, he's reading here in London on the 18th of May, Gilbert? Right, in Gilbert Adair's series, Sub Voicive. You can check it out with him. So it'll be a great occasion. His poetry, Jerome Rothenberg's, opened in the 1960s. We discussed this. He and I did a book of discussions together called The Riverside Interviews, number 4. And so a lot of these issues can be obtained there. Basically, what we were talking about is this: the range of his poetics fusing with the range of his researches into other cultures and ethnopoetics. He's published translations of a very particular kind from the German, from the Spanish versions of Aztec, from the Navajo, the Seneca, the Hebrew. In 1966, beginning with a book called Ritual, he assembled long collections of intercultural materials, major Christophanies of very great value, which have changed, I think, and many others do, changed the definition of poetry. In 1978, with Dorian Lenovitz, as I said, he published with them Origins. Now they worked the book called A Big Jewish Book, which is a very large collection of writings for that inheritance, which, speaking as someone who was never instructed in what Jewish culture was ever at school, and certainly not at university, was an absolute revelation to me. So it was, again, this sense of entering other people beside Americans. So there's that part of his life, investigations of those materials. His own Jewish inheritance, he entered a book of poems about that. It appeared in 1969, called Poland, 1931, about his Polish Jewish ancestry. And now in 1989, in fact, the book's just come out, so it's a bit late, his book called Churbin, that's K-H-U-R-B-I-N, which is the Yiddish, he tells us, for total destruction, or what the English-speaking world dangerously calls Holocaust, which Jerry says is too Christian and too beautiful to use. So he uses the word in Yiddish for total destruction in his preface. And he writes about how a decade after his first Poland 1931 poem on his Jewish origins, he went to Poland for the first time and discovered that the town his parents had left in 1920 was only 15 miles from Treblinka. And I quote, his surviving uncle had gone into the woods with Jewish partisans, which I'd never heard of, I may say. But discovering his family had been murdered at Treblinka, drank himself blind in a deserted cellar, and blew his brains out. This too must still be placed in the intercultural continuities. So Rothenberg I'm taking here as being a preeminent, not only American, but for all of us, intercultural poetics. The first magazine he edited, it was called Poems from the Floating World, 1960. And it holds a confirmed sense of the need for the work of a whole range of writers throughout the world. I won't list it out, but it did include Nahuatl translations. And his aim, to show that poetry is transnational and transtemporal. The modern European poetry and the archaic and or primitive poetry to which it is spiritually linked can, for all its difference, be translated into American terms. In 1962, he produced his own poems called The Seven Hills of Jigoku Zoshin, which were versions of 12th century Japanese scroll of poems called The Scroll of Hells, as a way of discovering not only ethnic sources, but new techniques of writing. Looking back to that, 3 years later, he writes, I began to sense image as a power among several by which the poem is cited and brought close. He calls this the study of the text, leading in a world cut off from vision and thereby incomplete to reconsideration of the poem's roots in, for example, shamans, and to a growing sense of powers, new and old, of word and song and image, still here as keys for any man who reaches for them to his own limits and spite of cautionary schools, which is exactly one of the things that we've been listening to in terms of repossessing the word. Translation, then, is the crucial process. Translation is always a cultural translation. It's always a cultural transaction, rather than the reduction by verbal action. So it leads, for Rothenberg, to a working out of equivalence, the proper equivalence of texts and performances. He has been preeminently the man that understands that you can't translate the poem completely, like from one language into another. You have to find cultural equivalence, and you have to find performance equivalence at the same time. And I'm sure you know about this. This sense of him trying to find ways of, in English, in American English, of performing a translation of a Seneca poem, for instance, things like that. And also he's used repeatedly modern technology, cassettes, LPs, and so forth, to do this so that you can actually see the poet doing this performance. So the translation is an oral and a visual and a printed textual action of that simultaneity. Now that is new. And that is a cross-cultural action of tremendous importance and a cross-technological one as well. Very much disliked by the English department, I must say, who think the text is what they can see with their eyes, and it's called print. How pathetic can you get? In 1968, Rothenberg published one of the most revelatory and stimulating American books of the century, which Clive mentioned, Technicians of the Sacred. And there's a revised, augmented edition in 1985. This is a remarkable record of discovery and knowledge, which helps to fulfill Charles Olson's proposal in 1956 at Black Mountain College in a book called The Special View of History. Have a look at the section called The Stance. I take it this is where Jerry is moving from. One, by inquiry, the knowledge so obtained. Two, and the written account of one's inquiries, a sense first traceable in Herodotus. Herodotus, for Olson and for many other writers, is that Greek historian and traveler in Europe, Asia, and Africa. A traveler in Europe, Asia, and Africa, who was a historian as well, in the 5th century BC. Olson writes of the recognition, inquiry, picture, story of how to obtain the density equal to what went on. Equal to what went on. Out of your own need, that is, to place what happens to oneself inside what happens and happened. Quote, it isn't a question of fiction versus knowing, nor the mistaken either or of science or fiction. These splits must be healed, he says. And the figure he uses is the figure of historien, that's I-S-T-O-I-R-N, finding out for oneself. It's rather like Ezra Pound's idea of periplus, that is, a voyage of discovery and mapping, or, and Whitman was mentioned by Clive, a poetics of discovery, plus the word initia, that is, to begin, to initiate, to find out. That's, I want to bring in here, I can't remember whether, yes, I think Clive did mention, the great American philosophical scientist and technologist, Buckminster Fuller, a man I admire very, very strongly indeed, and seems to be someone we should study much more. What he called total thinking. That, again, is the title of a paper originally given at that extraordinary place called Black Mountain College, where a lot of this material was originally thought out for many Americans, in 1949. He calls total thinking comprehensive disciplines and the developed ability to synthesize. But if you don't know, please check it out for yourself. There used to be a Pelican book of Buckminster Fuller's work. I don't know whether it's print now, but it used to be. You can hunt it around. Or it's Buckminster Fuller's work in a volume called Ideas and Integrities. In the 1970s, Rothenberg and the anthropologist Dennis Tedlock founded an essential magazine of ethnopoetics to carry on the work established in Technicians of the Sacred, called Alturinga. And significantly, that is an Australian Aboriginal word of great potency, meaning the dream time, or the eternal dream, or the eternal dream time, or the dream that speaks about the mythological past as it was for the eternal beings, and it is manifesting in itself in the present day in our own songs and poetry. I'm quoting. And you can imagine that would be a good reason for the beginning of the 1968 preface to Technicians of the Sacred, which begins, primitive means complex. end of all those ideas. You can use the word primitive, being, you know, like you were saying, they're simple. And once and for all. And as Clive was saying, the implication is, and Rothenberg says it, there are no simple languages. And what is true of languages is true of cultures. It is not simply unforgivable to do it. It is totally inaccurate to pretend that there are primitive peoples, primitive languages. Everywhere a development has taken place into structures of great complexity. What is true of language in general is equally true of poetry and of the internal systems of which such poetry is a part. It's a question of energy and intelligence as universal constants, and in any specific case, the direction that energy and intelligence, that is, imagination, have been given. No people today is newly born. The variety that that implies is what Rothenberg has dedicated his life to. I'm quoting now from the 1904 preface to that book. "We can no longer assume that the poetry of traditional cultures aims at stasis rather than at change, transformation, not only in a mystical sense, but in a social sense as well. For in Charles Olson's paraphrase of Heraclitus, what does not change is the will to change." Clive mentioned Rothenberg's publication called Shaking the Pumpkin, which was a second collection, this time of North American Indian materials. And we've heard from both Dave Murray and Bob Lee enough for me to skip this part. But finally, I will add an extraordinary book, which I don't think any of us will ever assimilate. And it all from William Burroughs' idea, being assimilated. Assimilated, as he says. 1983 came out a book by Jerome Rothenberg and his wife, Diane, called Symposium of the Whole, a range of discourses towards an ethnopoetics. This is a remarkable book. The title nearly conceals the contents of one of the few books one might consider, I think, vital to anyone's education. Its range is accurately large, and once again it brings together, side by side, texts which are necessarily without regard for panic-stricken divisiveness of separate disciplines and the separately disciplined people. Anthropologists, poets, linguists, philosophers, ethnographers, and experts in theatre are placed side by side in a field of relationships which causes their work to be immediately interceptive and transactory. And the Rothenbergs maintain an exemplary intercultural optimism, which is in itself radicalist today. I quote, "When the industrial West began to discover and plunder, quote, new, unquote, and quote, old, unquote, worlds, when the industrial West began to discover and plunder new and old worlds beyond its boundaries, an extraordinary counter-movement came into being in the West itself. Alongside the official ideologies that shoved European man to the apex of the human pyramid, there were some thinkers and artists who found ways of doing and knowing among the peoples as complex as any in Europe and often virtually erased from European consciousness. These forms appear, quote, revolutionary from a later European perspective, a series of counterparts somewhere in the traditional world the West was savaging." And Rothenberg then uses another essay by Olson called Human Universe. It was written by Olson at the time when he was and had been investigating and respecting Mayan culture in Central America, which appears in his Mayan letters. Quote, "There are laws, that is to say, the human universe is as discoverable as that other and as definable. We are ourselves both the instruments of discovery and the instruments of definition." You can see, as someone also mentioned in our discussions today, long before the fashionable structuralist, Olson was constructing a critique of the assumed laws of universal discourse and those assumptions that, I quote, language was an absolute. Again, which both Dave Murray and Bob were into in their respective talks. So he uses the Maya as an example of not, quote, exaggerating the word universe. As we did that. And that was related very much to Henry Adams' idea of multiverse, and multiplicities, which you were talking about a bit, Clive, was it not? There. We live in a multiverse, and the word universe is far too dangerously inexplicit. So it uses the Mayan civilization and its masks, its inscriptions, its general sense of inheriting and being disinherited as an example of our cultures. He had read, in fact, I don't think an author that an investigator had not appeared in our discussions, Leo Frobenius. One of the most important books, I think, of the 20th century is African Genesis of 1923, which enables us into technique. When I was thinking about this stuff, I recalled an extraordinary occasion at the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, which is an educational side of the first Buddhist university in America, which I've had the privilege of working at. I'll be back quickly, I'm not a Buddhist, however much one tries. I've got bad knees, I think. But there's this sense of a summer literature program in which artists and poets and writers from all over America, all over Europe, all over the world turn up and try to get into each other's lives and their works and with an extraordinary audience. And I had one example I remember in July 84 on the platform was Norman Mailer and William Burroughs. And I can't imagine two more different people than that reading in public together for the first time from their most recent writings. And then it turned out they were both writing about ancient Egyptian materials, which is rapidly alarming. And they were obviously both very startled that they had that conjunction and hadn't known it at all. Then it was very clear why, as contemporary Americans, with their sense of an investigation of culture, would get into that they would use those Egyptian ideas. Which I thought was a classic case. There they were on the platform in a tantric Buddhist university using Egyptian materials. One, St. Louis, ex-Protestant, I'm going to say quickly, drug investigating homosexual writer of great power, and the other, a Jewish New York, a novelist, and a great writer on politics, meeting together like that, and having a lot to say to each other and to us. And I remember also, at the same time, speaking at Naropa to Anne Waldman, very distinguished American poet, herself a student of yoga, who had worked and studied in India, and a fine poet performer, very much interested in South American Indian women shamans. I think that's an example of one's own experience entering into this particular material. I'd like to add here too, besides Letters for Origin, which was turned out to be an extremely fine magazine Origin. One of the things we don't study enough, we use, but we don't study as a subject, although we did try and put a course on, didn't we, at the Institute, as the little magazines. It didn't work at all, did it? For various reasons, we better not get into it. But I think I'd like to draw attention to this. Not only was there the Letters from Origin about the magazine Origin, but also there was plannings of other magazines, and they came through at this time. I mentioned Black Mountain College in North Carolina. That college's program itself represented the 1950s an international intercultural school for artists, both verbal and visual, which has never been repeated. I think it was an example of education like the kind of proposition Martin Heidegger thinks of when he writes of the necessity of preparation and readiness in an artist, a poet, or any of us, if we are going to do more than be a petty inscriber of our own enclosing egos, that particular way. That is, training must be something in the nature of Black Mountain College or Black Mountain Review, which was the review of that area. Later, but I don't want to go into all the context here, there were a number of exemplary magazines of tremendous range in America. And I just want to say one or two of them. And Will Rowe will know about El Corno Emplumado, which was a Latin American, basically intercultural cross-translatory magazine a tremendous power, which went to, I think, something like 30 issues, something of that kind, about 32 issues, edited by Margaret Randall and Sergio Mondragon, Charles Newman's Tri-Quarterly, Clayton Escherman's magazine called Caterpillar, a magazine called Culture, which is edited by various people, a wonderful magazine which is launched in this country called Art and Literature, edited by John Ashbery and others, IO magazine, edited by Richard Grossinger, an extraordinary collection of writings of various kinds right across the cultures. I think defunct now. I haven't seen it for a long time. Seize copies if you can find them. Magazine called Etc. from the International Society of General Semantics, in which the title of this conference was taken, I may say, by Korzybski. And still going, a magazine called Boundary 2, which is a significant title in this context, which is vastly cross-cultural and totally bewildering. This thing is an old lag here. That sense, then, of what, in fact, Ezra Pound called a paiduma of necessary intelligence. That is, a serious poetics of frontier crossings, of cross-cultural fields, in a state of preparation to be a necessary readership and creative action. Many shops were developed in America, too, along these lines. The 8th Street Bookshop in New York, and a famous one in San Francisco, where, in fact, these were poetry bookshops. What they contained was a huge range of materials that we all ought to be into. And we have one great shop in London called Better Books, which tried to emulate that under a very distinguished American poet, a very sad one, called Bill Butler, and then, of course, by a great British poet called Bob Cobbing. It was tried out in Tottenham Court Road and was soon scheduled for what capitalism calls development, which meant it closed. That idea of Pound's paiduma, then, of ideas in action to be mapped and plotted from anywhere that appears to be a necessity, is the gist of a great deal of what I've been saying today. Or you can say, you can use the word by Olson called proprioception. Proprioception. This first appeared in magazine Culture, I mentioned just now, the first issue in 1960, positing through this term a data of depth sensibility, a person's own order within knowledge which produces experience, a human universe in the sense of proprius, one's own. And he writes, the soul is proprioceptive, that is, an ideal form. He also uses Keats's idea of the man of power, and the man of achievement, the person for whom, as Olson says, beauty is a permanence of creation, a process. And I was thinking of Pound's great words, there's no substitute for a lifetime. It does take time to get this thing going. One of the most interesting phenomena here was Charles Olson's founding at the State University of New York, the Institute of Further Studies. This he projected as a course, first of all, and then it became a set of short books for a curriculum of the soul, that's his phrase. Soul meaning the product that a person produces within the paiduma, within proprioception, within the creative process. So his plan was then for a curriculum of the soul. And the books that arrived out of that, there were at least 28 small books. Robert Duncan on Dante, which Clive was talking about in his talk. George Butterick on the Norse. Edward Kissam on the Arabs. John Clark on Blake. Robin Blaise on Bach and his beliefs. Edward Sanders on Egyptian hieroglyphs. Harvey Brown on jazz playing. And Edward Dorn on language. And there were texts on American Indians and dance. I expect David knows about those. Again, you see it was like a symposium of the whole, but it was a teaching program for graduates in the State University of New York of extreme power. One or two examples then, and I think that Henry Adams have been extremely pleased to know that there was this set of multiplicities going on in later universities, particularly as you remember that bit in Pound's Cantos where he's quoted as saying, remember, teach at Harvard, can't be done. Powell says he had it from the master, meaning Henry James. I have, yeah, I have views on that. Anyway, one or two things of that kind I wanted to project in our course here, and just a little bit to end up with to suggest something else. But this is an enormous field, and I said at the beginning I'm only going to suggest some things rather than going to. I've been for many, many years very interested in what I think is a bit stupidly called the Beat Generation writers now. Because, you know, they're getting a bit long in the tooth, aren't we all? But I mean, that's associated with, it's really sad. I get students wanting to teach the Beat Generation, and when they find that, you know, Burroughs is 74 or something, they get terribly worried about this. And there was a most amazing occasion at the Institute when Allen Ginsberg turned up, remember, at the Institute of United States Studies. And I remember you got very worried because they were throwing stones at the window and wanting the great man to appear on the balcony and wave to the crowd like royalty, which he did. And but you remember at the end there was a very young man asked, and this was, you know, only about a few years ago, and to Allen Ginsberg's perturbation at the end, when the question time came, he put his hand up and he asked Allen, how's Jack? I mean, Kerouac had been dead a long time. That was a very strange feeling for this young guy. They're still alive, and it is like that still. There's this kind of strange attraction here, right across the cultural frontiers. But I have a great deal of materials on this, which I'm not going to deliver, and I don't brought it with me. But I'd like to place it, that sense of Ginsberg, for instance, in Yucatan, where Charles Olson was there, and it was extraordinary experiences working with the villagers. And at one point, most intriguingly, leading a march up a volcano to convince the villagers that it wasn't sacred or dangerous, and it wasn't going to explode, and it didn't contain any ruins of gods with horrible specters at the top. Did you know about that, Will? I'm glad I told you that. And that sense of that he was deeply involved in that deconstruction of superstition in that particular way. And then going to Latin, to South America, and following William Burroughs's experiment in changing consciousness through endless visits to actual shamans in tribes, working out what the effects of the drugs were on consciousness, to like break the sets of consciousness, to cross the frontiers, the sets of your own closures of mind. And Allen then going to North Africa, where Burroughs was. Then later, going to Moscow to check, like Jerome Rothenberg, check out his Jewish ancestors. And then off to India twice, and then recently to China. That sense of, I got a feeling after I've been traveling around a bit, everywhere I've been, Allen had just been there before me. And everybody wanted to know about him, not me. Well, that's not natural. But there's a sense that the man has been investigating, and what's more, not just tourizing, but to living in the places and making contact with those people that people remember. There's that exchange going on. A very impressive man, indeed. And a great deal of Kerouac's work, I may say, is transcultural in a very curious way. He traveled quite a bit, but his was very much through his reading. He studied at Columbia University and took courses whose European and other cultural texts penetrated his mind and sensibility. So that his writing, I think a book like Visions of Cody, is absolutely impregnated with the literature of the world. I mean, you carried Proust around with him the whole time, anyway, to keep that going. And his own interest in his Breton and Indian ancestors as well, it haunted him, because he wanted to know about that, you see. That sense there. And I could go on about these writers quite a bit, but I won't. But I want to place that on the map as well. And just end with what I think is a very useful passage from Anti-Oedipus by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari. Remember the subtitle of Anti-Oedipus, which came out in 72, is called Capitalism and Schizophrenia. They're thinking about this tradition in the United States. Specifically here, Henry Miller, who I could give a whole lecture on his transactions in Greece, in Colossus of Marussi and things of that kind, which changed his life. A wonderful book, that. And he's talking about, these two writers are talking about Ginsberg and others in America, who knew how to leave, how to scramble the codes, to cause flows to circulate. They overcome a limit. They shatter a wall, a capitalist barrier. And of course, they fail to complete the process. They never cease failing to do so. The neurotic impasse again closes. Oedipalization, America, the return to the native land, or else the perversion of the exotic territorialities, a stream of words that do not let themselves be coded. And then they speak of how poorly the problem of literature is put by interpreters, starting from the ideology that it bears, or from the co-option of it by a social order. Ideology is the most confused notion because it keeps us from seizing the relationship of the literary machine with the field of production. And a moment when the emitted sign, and I think this is your inscription again here, Bob, the emitted sign breaks through this form of the content. The emitted sign breaks through this form of the content. For literature, they say, is like schizophrenia, a process and not a goal, a production and not an expression. And later in the book, they actually use Kerouac as the example of immersion in dreams of a great America, but in search of his Breton ancestors of the superior race. Isn't the destiny of American literature that of crossing limits and frontiers, causing deterritorialized flows of desire to circulate, but also always making these flows transport, transgress, fascicizing, moralizing, Puritan, and familiarist territorialities. Frontiers, William Carlos Williams said, is many places you can't sleep. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'd just like to just say one final thank you on everybody here's behalf, not just mine, to thank the organisers of the Institute of United States Studies for a really, really pleasantly organised day. And I'd like to also thank the speakers very much and the people asking questions and for all of you to be here. Thank you very much.